Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, July 17th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is Al Trost. Session number is 98-4 and is titled Islam's Role in World Politics. Let's listen in.
I was a little, I won't say apprehensive, actually. If no one would have shown up, I could have gone back and taken a nap. Often, that's one of my fantasies with classes, is that I'll show up and nobody will be there. This is a shift of time. I've been doing this at 10:30, and today was an exception. So I didn't know whether people would be inclined to come out this late in the hot afternoon or not. My chief goal today is to present an accurate picture of Muslims. That's the word for the adherence to Islam. Muslims in the world today and what they seemingly want to do and what they have done. We have, of course, a lot of stereotypes, most of them negative, of Muslims. I think part of this is the decline of the Cold War. You need somebody to be an enemy in movies and books. And because Iran and Iraq have caused us a little bit of trouble, I think oftentimes people creating fiction believe that it's okay to move Arabs or Iranians into this position. But again, what I'd like to do today is to talk more accurately and let you, for yourself, come to some kinds of analysis or judgments, evaluations of what the situation is. To begin with, along this line, and this is the one-use press of the handout that I gave you, and that is that Muslims are not confined to the Arab world, to the Middle East. I'm sure most of you know that. It's been brought to our awareness in this country, of course, by the breakup of Yugoslavia, where we've discovered that a portion of the population of Bosnia is Muslim, and now in the news, Kosovo, we found out that a large majority of that population is also Muslim. So this is one place in Europe, in fact, where there is a substantial number of Muslims. The largest Muslim country in the world is Indonesia, way off here. I'm sure you don't know where it is, but way off here in Southeast Asia. And there's a second Muslim country here, Malaysia. Both of those countries have over 95% Muslims. The one exception in Indonesia is the island of Bali, which is Hindu, and some of the Penang, some of the urban centers in Malaysia have some Indian immigrants, and that's the only exception really to the Muslim population there. You also know that the partition of India in 1947 resulted in the creation of a Muslim state in South Asia, Pakistan. And still 11% of the Indian population is Muslim. In fact, if you would kind of rank populations of Muslims, India would be third or fourth on the list, because 11% of 800 million people is still a considerable number of people. So that is a relatively easy thing to communicate, but again, I think kind of goes against popular perception that identifies Islam with the Middle East, especially with people confronting the Israel and the Jews. What has brought Islam to the attention, especially of people in international relations and diplomats, people active in world affairs, is the resurgence of something that is somewhat inaccurately called, we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute, Islamic fundamentalism. Most of us didn't give much of a thought to Islam before the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Now that has occurred, And we see kind of ripples of it in Lebanon, and now in the Sudan and Algeria. It is something that does now kind of crowd in on our attention. And I think, you know, one of the things about calling it Islamic fundamentalism that probably is good is it's distinguished from something else, Islamic non-fundamentalism, which conveys that there is something else to that religion than what we are seeing in this very militant and often violent activity, especially in Algeria and in the Sudan. Islamic, what is called Islamic fundamentalism, and again, I think that is a bit inaccurate because we always want to use Christian fundamentalism here as the kind of counterpart to that or analog, and that's not right. But one of the its main goal is to restore Islam as the foundation of the state. To move Islamic law, called Sharia, to the position of a constitution, to the position of the only law of the land. That is what people call Islamic fundamentalists want to do. And they maintain, and if one looks especially at the Quran and the Sunnah, they are right. I mean, this is something that is very explicit. That states should be run according to God's law. So that is their agenda. It's also, I think, worthwhile to note that the Quran talks about this as a kind of peaceful happening. In fact, there are kind of three scenarios that are drawn out. One is a peaceful expansion of the community. A second is an expansion that comes because there's aggression against the community. That would, of course, be a violent response and could result in the expansion of the community or the imposition of Islamic law. And the third possibility is very clearly identified as not God's intention, and that is for Islamic people, Muslims, to aggress against others. To expand and create an empire. That is outside the bounds of legitimacy. So, let me talk a little bit about how Islamic fundamentalism is like American Christian fundamentalism and how it is not. And then I want to talk a little bit more about some of the characteristics of Islam in general that are important for its political role. It is like American fundamentalism in that it is a reaction to modernism, to the intrusion of modernity and liberal political ideas into the Islamic world. And the date usually given for the start of Islamic fundamentalism is the creation of the Muslim Brothers in Egypt in 1925, which is somewhat around the time of the creation of the American movement of fundamentalism, Machen and Princeton, part of the Princeton Theological Faculty. So that these, you can see that things that were happening in the world at that time in terms of the communication of modern ideas, of some of the changes that were attendant in the 1920s, are both provocative of this fundamentalist reaction. The other way in which it is very similar to the fundamentalists as we know them, at least manifested in the Christian right in the United States right now, is that Islamic fundamentalists certainly do want to create a very strict code of family conduct, and also a very punitive criminal justice system, one that reacts to people who disobey the law quite emphatically, quite speedily. And so these two elements, kind of a social doctrine, if you will, are common between the Christian variety and the Islamic variety. But there are also some kind of fundamental differences. One of these is that Islamic fundamentalism very clearly is open to new interpretations of Sharia, of the Islamic law. There are Muslims, and in fact quite a large number of them, who believe that interpretations of God's law stopped around 1,000 years after the birth of Christ, or several centuries after Muhammad, and that it's illegitimate to reinterpret God's law after that. But that's not the position of, the movement that's called Islamic fundamentalism. In fact, there's a fairly famous speech given by Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran in 1988, where he says that Islam should be constantly reinterpreting the law. And Islamic states that don't do that have betrayed their Islamic inheritance. So in that sense, to kind of move to some new sources of the theology or of law, which is about the extent, at least, of what the people see of Islamic theology, there is room in what's called Islamic fundamentalism for interpretation. Another one
that contrast with Christian fundamentalism, and
yes,
it's routine, static.
Well, at least the kind of fundamental texts there remain about the same. I mean, it's the Bible, the words of the martyrs. I haven't been inside of that movement, so I can't say for sure. But at least what I read about the Christian right and about fundamentalism, even the so-called old Christian right, Carl McIntyre and those people, it seems as if the texts that they want to deal with are certainly just the classical texts, and there is no, especially when we get to scripture, there really is nothing new, valuable that's been said. Another way in which it differs from American fundamentalism is that the economic implications of Islamic fundamentalism are quite radical. I mean, we would probably use labels like socialism. When you look at the agenda of the Muslim Brothers in the Sudan, or of the National Salvation Party in Turkey, or one of the other fundamentalist movements, they certainly stand for radical land reform, breaking up the large holdings of land and giving it to the peasants. Another common feature is the nationalization of private property, and certainly a property held by foreign companies, and again turning this property over to the Muslim community in some form. So obviously this is very different also from what we see as the kind of political position of American fundamentalism. So when you read books on world religion, usually this kind of movement is called Islamism, or the people who adhere to it, Islamists. But I don't, to use that is to introduce an unfamiliar term, and your tongue can get tied here, and pretty soon you're saying the wrong thing again, kind of branding all adherents to Islam with the same brush. Now let me talk a little bit about some of the concepts here that are important for the political role of Islam. They are like, Islam is like Christianity in some organizational and structural aspects, I suppose, in that, as I was just indicating with fundamentalism, they have experienced some of the same movements in their theological tradition. A major movement in Islam, especially at the last part of the 19th century, was both a kind of rationalist current and also a modernist current. So, you can, if you study Islam, and I must admit I've only had two semesters of this, but if you study it, you can read the writings of people who represent some of the same currents that are in Christian theology. There's also a monastic current in Islam. There's a mystical current in Islam. The mystical current is more important in Egypt probably than any place else, but it's throughout at least the Middle East, and there's even some visible evidence of it in Pakistan. The one, I suppose, that we are most aware of, and this is, again, one of the dangerous stereotypes, is the schisms within Islam. The major one is the break between the movement called Sunnism and the Shiites. I'm sure most of you heard these terms during the Iranian Revolution, where, again, after it had gone on for a little bit, there were a lot of background articles talking about how these Muslims were a bit different than the Muslims, for instance, in Palestine, or the Muslims in Turkey, or in Egypt, or in North Africa. This is not a new schism. It's, in fact, a very old one, but Khomeini and the Iranians have given it a kind of new definition. But this is something that happened, actually, way back in the 9th century, where this was an issue that kind of split the Muslim movement, and it was based upon the lines of inheriting rulership within the Muslim world. And the Shiites believe that the line, the legitimate line of rulership, inheritance, runs through Muhammad's son-in-law, and the Sunnis' basic position is that the line of inheritance runs through election. And this is a myth, of course, because the community has been too large to have any kind of election. But this was the initial reason for the break. Shiites comprise about 10% of the Muslim world. Sunnis are in the vast, overwhelming majority. And the Shiite population is pretty much concentrated in Iran and southern Iraq, and there is a substantial minority in Pakistan, and some Shiites also in Lebanon. But the kind of center of Shiism is Iran, mainly because of the Iranian Revolution. Most of the holy sites for Shiism are in southern Iraq. And so this is why Iran and Iraq, one of the reasons they fought a war, is because Saddam Hussein sees the Shiites as a kind of fifth column in Iraqi society. Their loyalty, he believes, is primarily to Iran. That's not the only reason. Oil, of course, is a big factor here. Just territorial aspirations, especially these days, by the Iraqis. But this is certainly an element in the conflict. Well. Let me now talk about more distinctive elements. Yes, go ahead.
Would the Sunnis be more peace-loving than the Shiites, so to speak? Or?
Well, the great tradition in both of those movements has been quietism, especially on the part of the people. I mean, that there's a very clear, Islam, to start with, is one is identified as a Muslim by a pattern of behavior. You were talking a bit about some of this in your presentation the other day on Palestine. I mean, the prayer routine, the pilgrimage to Mecca, this is what defines a Muslim. The vast majority of Muslims don't get into doctrinal things at all. This is left to an elite, the ulama, they're called. I'm just going to talk a little bit about those that group in a minute. But there is a very clear elitism in that sense in Islam. And I think that the followers of the tradition has been one of quietism. Yes?
Who were these enthusiastic people running around shooting their rifles off in the air, shouting, Jihad, Allah Akbar?
Well, they are followers of some of the leaders in the Shiite movement.
That is Muslim.
Yes, and in Algeria, they would be Sunnis. I need to develop something before I can explain that accurately, and something that will satisfy me anyway. In Islam, there is no distinction between religion and politics or between church and state. Again, people who type these things, and the first day some of you were here, I did this with the world religions. There are sacerdotal movements, religions. Christianity is one where you have a priesthood. Only certain people, for instance, can engage in certain religious practices. Distribution of the sacraments, and so forth. I know that's not true of all Christian denominations, but that's one understanding of a church. In Islam and in Hinduism, there is a kind of holistic approach here, an organic wholeness, where religion and politics, church and the state, are the same thing. The state has to be religious to be a legitimate Islamic state. And the religion is incomplete if the Islamic state is not there. So it's really one and the same thing. One of the things, again, that Khomeini said, again, in this 1988 speech was that religion, the Islamic religion, is missing an essential element in the absence of a state based on Islamic law. Now, a second thing about Islam that I wanted to mention here, which has political implications, and that is that Islam claims to create a community, the Ummah, that unites all of its members, all Muslims, without regard to racial, national, or other differences. And then this community, the Ummah, is expected to be under one government. The division of the Islamic world into nation states is, again, a deviation that is not legitimate. Nationalism is anathema to an Orthodox or conventional Muslim. The whole community is to be under one government or one state. Now, this is something that was abandoned in realistic terms, in practical political terms, in the 19th century. But it still remains part of, at least, again, some of the people who are identified with the fundamentalist movement. The division of the Islamic world into is usually the division of the Islamic world into nation states is wrong, but also the inclusion in the Ummah, or the community of non-Muslims, is also considered to be wrong. And in the states that have gone too far in the direction of toleration of other Muslims, to the extent that they are given equal political rights in the community, these are, again, our targets of the Islamic fundamentalists. Now, there is, as some of you who have looked at Islam a little bit know, there is a mandate for a tolerance, giving a certain degree of autonomy to other so-called people of the book, people who practice a revelatory religion like Christianity or Judaism. They are to be given their section, their enclave in Muslim societies, and they are also exempted from, in the sense that they stay in their community or enclave, from Islamic law. If they move in Islamic society, then they are subject to Islamic law. And we have a case, had a case recently, of three nurses right in Saudi Arabia who moved into the Islamic sector and were threatened with a very punitive and horrific kind of penalty for moving into Islamic society. But the autonomy is guaranteed, and the exemption from Islamic law is guaranteed, and protection is guaranteed as long as the non-Muslims stay in their own sector. Another politically relevant idea of Islam, and that is the area controlled by this Islamic State, not again any kind of current nation state, but the area controlled by an Islamic State that would actually be coterminous with the Islamic community, is called in the Quran the abode of peace. The other part that's not within the abode of peace is called the abode of war. The whole world, according to the Quran, is eventually to be included in the abode of peace. And again, as I was mentioning before, this can be done peacefully. It can be done in a self-defense way, but it should not be done aggressively. The abode of peace can include, again, these non-Muslim areas. That certainly is possible. The Islamic fundamentalists have, however, in most of the practical cases right now, have not tolerated non-Christian communities. The main case of this is in Egypt, where the Muslim Brothers have been behind a lot of attacks on Coptic Christians. I don't know, you know, how much this kind of news is carried in the Seattle paper, or I know it's not carried very frequently in the Chicago Tribune or the Chicago Sun-Times, but occasionally you'll see these news briefs from around the world, you'll see that there was an attack on a Coptic village by Muslim Brothers. Now, it's very important, again, to see that this is not an attack by Muslims. It's not an attack by the Egyptian government. These are of either members of the Brotherhood or members of Jihad or members of one of the other Hamas, one of the other Islamic fundamentalist movements. There are other places where this goes on as well, but I think the Egyptian case involves Coptic Christian Egyptians, and so from that standpoint, I think it's a clear indication of, again, how the Islamic fundamentalist movement has so far, in this sense, been somewhat non-doctrinal, if one can say, and I think it's incorrect to say that Islam has a doctrine, but they have certainly gone against the law. Now, the body of revealed law, as I was mentioning before, is called Sharia, or Sharia, and it's based on the Quran, which is the word of God as given to Muhammad, the Sunnah, which are reports and sayings and actions of Muhammad himself. A third element is the consensus of the Ummah, or the community. If the community agrees, this is added to Sharia. Now, practically speaking, this consensus or agreement usually only involves, again, the Ulama, who are a group of people who are experts in, have studied Sharia to start with. There is no clergy, again, in Islam. The one elite group is the group of Islamic lawyers. And in some societies, the Egyptian society for political system, for instance, the ulama are very much people who have the sanction of the Egyptian government. There is an Islamic university in Egypt. The appointments to the Islamic university are made by the Egyptian government. And the major ruling body of the ulama is in the Muslim university. And these appointments come from the government. And the record of the lawyers, most of the lawyers in Egypt, has been to support government policy. For instance, in 1952, when Nasser came to power, again, most of you are old enough to remember Nasser. These names to students, undergraduate students, or you might as well be naming obscure Armenian poets. Nasser came to power in 1952. certainly of a Muslim. One of the things that he wanted to do was to bring a kind of version of European socialism, probably closer to British Fabianism than anything else, to Egypt. Initially, the ulama said that this was not legitimate under the Sharia. 2 years later, in 1954, the ulama unanimously said that Nasser's version of socialism was definitely Islamic. And this has happened many times over the course of recent Egyptian political history. This is also the case in Tunisia and many of the Muslim states, especially in the Middle East, where the ulama have really been, for all intents and purposes, subservient to the rulers of the state. Now, that, in some senses, goes along with some kinds of Islamic fundamentalist thinking, in that they don't believe these people should have much power anyway, especially to reinterpret the Sharia. So in some of these cases, the fundamentalists can live at peace with a ruler who is not as conspicuously behind their agenda otherwise as the ideal might be. And that is why in many of the Muslim societies you don't see this Islamic fundamentalism coming to the fore, because one of the things these rulers do is hold down the ulama, which means also holding down their interpretive activity as regards Islamic law. The one other thing that it's kind of interesting to me, but may not be to you, is that the fourth thing that is part of the Sharia in the Sunni tradition is analogy. And so if one can analogically reason out of what is written down, that then can become part of Sharia. In the Shiite tradition, reason has to be the basis for the addition to the law. Now, these, you know, you have to be a kind of logician here to see some of the differences between these two. But what it has meant is that there's far more room for interpretation, again, in the Shiite tradition, interpretation of the law, than there is in the Sunni tradition. Another feature. The function of an Islamic community is therefore to defend and expand the Islamic state, and the job of the ruler is to enforce Islamic law. This is again the clear message that the Islamic fundamentalists are trying to deliver. Again, the function of an Islamic community is to defend and expand the borders of the Islamic state and to enforce Islamic law, Sharia. In the classical Islamic conception of this, the ruler has no legislative authority. The legislative authority is God. So if you use a separation of powers kind of idea here, God is Congress. The ruler is the executive branch. And the ulama is the Supreme Court. They settle disagreements between the ruler and God's law. Again, in conservative Muslim states, they don't have much room for interpretation. This is the Supreme Court in the 19th century in the United States. In more secularized Islamic communities are in ones in which, like Iran, in the Shiite tradition, where they have more power, they're more like an activist Supreme Court in doing this, so that their word, in some respects, becomes as clear and as emphatic as the word of God. So it's not an entirely accurate analogy here, but it's one that has helped me and help my students understand how an Islamic state is supposed to operate. One of the people who has written on Islamic, political role has called this a nomocracy, N-O-M-O, because the source of law, is the Sharia. It's not legitimate for there to be any person handing down the law. It is, I suppose, a theocracy in the sense that if the law is truly followed, this is God's law. So if theocracy, theo, means God ruling, it is in that simple sense of theocracy. If we mean instead Calvin's Geneva, where you have a kind of group of elders ruling, then that is not of the understanding in the Quran of an Islamic state. It's one run by Islamic law, and all the ruler is there to do, again, is to enforce that law, not to interpret it, not to add to it. Just one or two more here. As I said before, Islam has no priests or priesthood. There is no religious function that only consecrated persons may perform. Any Muslim can be a preacher. Any Muslim can be a prayer leader. But there is this category of learned people, again, the ulama, the plural of that, by the way, is alim, that has this kind of privileged status to interpret the law. And in a perfect Islamic state, or in the ideal Islamic state, that's all there is. Historically, well, go ahead, yes.
Does that include women? When you say any Muslim can
no,
be a...
No, it does not. No. I'm going to be talking next week on human rights, and in some respects, yeah, the Muslims, you know, there are a lot of problems there in that community, and that's one of them. But there is this category again of these learned people. The places where they are trained are called madrasas, and they then are the teachers in these schools. So they, in a sense, co-opt and train future Islamic lawyers. They act as, and again, a place like Saudi Arabia, where this is the only law, they act as both the judges and they are the legitimate, we would call them certified by the bar, or certified to practice before the bar in the United States. They are the certified lawyers in Saudi Arabia. What they learn at their schools is not really, again, theology as much as it is jurisprudence. Rules of interpretation for the Islamic law, ways to understand certain more ambiguous passages, the kinds of things, again, that we would do to a certain extent in some American law classes. Now, a lot of American law is taken up with learning cases, and there is no case law in Sharia. But a lot of what they do is to look at interpretations, especially of some prominent ulama from the past.
They don't have precedents.
What's that?
They don't have what we would call precedents.
No. Again, there are, depending on where you are, there are schools of ulama that are more recognized than others. And at different periods of history, certain interpretations have risen to the top where others have fallen down, but certainly nothing like the stare decisis rule in the American court system. So even these ulama are not the church. They don't stand against the state. In fact, in an ideal Islamic state, the ulama are in the bureaucracy. This is the case in Saudi Arabia, where if you're not a member of the royal family, really the only qualification, other qualification that permits you to enter the ministries of the Saudi government is a status as, again, an Islamic lawyer. And that specific monarchy in Saudi Arabia claims, as you probably know, to be descended from Muhammad. So that gives them a kind of status of caliph that few people today in the Muslim world can claim. This is one of the elements when a society modernizes in the Islamic world. Several things that they do. One is to start incorporating or bringing in some European law, especially in commercial law, or in criminal law. They start bringing in European ideas. Now, this is, again, not the common law system. This is the Roman law or civil law system that most European states use. They bring it in because it is brings in more evidentiary standards than Islamic law does. And again, for people who, and many citizens of Muslim countries have lived in Europe, and they see that law has a higher legitimacy than it does in Islamic states. And they get to believe that that is based upon the fact that it's perceived as just and containing equity. And so, or mercy, and so they begin, when they get control in their society, they begin bringing this in. The usual pattern in Islamic societies is for commercial law, criminal law, to begin pushing aside the Islamic law. Almost every Islamic state still abides by the Islamic law when it comes to family matters, to divorce, to marriage, to inheritance. But in areas in which the Muslim states have to interact with other modern states, the tendency has been to push out the Sharia. A second way in which Muslim states have modernized is that they've removed these leaders who claim some descent from Muhammad. The first state to do this was Turkey. In the 1920s, when they removed the caliph, the sultanate of the empire, the Ottoman Empire, and put in his place a secular leader. Now, many states have fallen into that tradition. We have in Egypt a president since Nasser. We have this in Tunisia for a long time, President Bourguiba was the first of the modern presidents there, and so many states have done that, and that is another element of the modernization of Islam. That's kind of interesting to me that only in the Shiite tradition has there been a call to reinstate descendants of the Prophet. Even in Egypt, the Muslim Brothers, this is not part of their agenda. They don't want to go back to a caliph, probably because the last King Farouk was somewhat illegitimate in that he was actually, as some of you know, a Balkan, and had a kind of very elaborate, kind of like, you know, getting the Mormon Church to kind of verify a certain line of descent for you. And so this has done something to delegitimize that kind of thing in Egypt. But this is not usually part of the agenda. The reinstitution of Sharia, though, is. This is very clearly the agenda of the Islamic fundamentalists. Let me, I have a few more things to say here, but let me stop there for a minute. I want to talk a little bit about Iran. Let me see if there are any questions. Yes, Terry?
With Muslims becoming increasingly numerous in this country, what do you see be the impact of Islam on political life, social reality generally in this country? I suppose that would include black Muslims maybe in thinking about that, but there was a recent notice from George Anderson, presiding at the ELCA, that mosques now outnumber ELCA churches in the United States. Mm-hmm. And increasing numbers of these folk, and they're highly professional. They tend to be professionals in this country.
Yes. Well, I think it's one of the critical variables here is for the Muslims to be grouped together in a community, and this is why I wouldn't want to back off of the black Muslims, for instance, in talking about a political agenda, because they have managed to maintain a much clearer community, partly because of segregation in housing in Chicago, but they have been able to maintain a community, and they have political clout, political power. We have tended to scatter all over the place and don't usually live in communities like that, and so it's harder for them to, I think, have political power. And the other thing that happens, at least in the Chicago area, is that at least the black Muslims have also been able to, in a sense, set up an island of different rules on, for instance, marriage and responsibility and financial integrity and honesty and that kind of thing. But again, it depends upon, I think, clearly defined geographical space. That may happen. You probably noticed too, since you reside partly in the Chicago area, that 12% of the Chicago population is now Islamic or Muslim.
Outnumber the Jewish population.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
At the present time in our political system, there's a very strong Jewish lobby. And if the Muslims were to get together and agree on an agenda, they could counterbalance that, which I think would be a healthy thing. Because at this point in time, any congressperson or president that questions our aid to Israel is not reelected. And so it's a very, very strong force.
Is it better than having the Jewish people have the Islamic people?
Well,
I think going back to something in a way of response to Terry, I think one of the difficulties for Muslim immigrants to this country is seeing this country as a good state for them. Part of it is probably the fact that they believe that the Jews have an inordinate amount of influence, but it is not the kind of community that makes it easy for them to practice their faith. I've been at O'Hare Field before and seen Muslims praying, and they get stares and occasionally some kind of comment, and this is not the country that they came from, in most cases, most of the Muslim countries, most of the countries where Muslims reside, India being the big exception here, the Muslims are in an overwhelming majority. And so to come to the United States is, I imagine, for them, for the immigrant population, kind of a strange development. And it's hard for them to feel efficacious or powerful in this system, I would think. And there's a question of whether, under the current setup here, whether it's even worth doing. The mosque really, I think, becomes the kind of center for their community, and this is where their energies are directed. Yes, Steve?
Do you think that some Muslim immigrants come here because they're not Islamic fundamentalists and don't want a Muslim state and welcome the separation of church and state? I'm just wondering, you said before that's a belief of Islam, and I'm wondering in communities and countries where Muslims have been a minority for a long time, I would think that's a belief that they've given up on or don't see
yes.
an integral part of their faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess I still believe that the major factor in immigration, probably for Muslims coming besides family already here, is probably economic. The chance to make it, and there are a number of, again, Muslim success stories here. Some major entrepreneurs in the Chicago area, again, are Muslim.
I guess my question then is, if they come for economic reasons, but in places where Muslims are a minority in general, do you think they hold on to this belief that there should be a Muslim state, or do you think that this is not a strong belief for those Muslims where they're a minority?
I guess it's a kind of general principle that's back there, but not held to with any kind of intensity. That's what I would say. Now, this would have to be something for a social scientist would have to empirically investigate this, and ask people and see what they say. My guess is it's a kind of like a lot of the tenets of Christianity, something that's kind of back there, as background, but not a major. not a major element. I mean, it's so far from realization here anyway, right? Just as in India, I mean, it's the same thing. That this can't be a major agenda. Again, for the ordinary Muslim, I think the big thing is practice. To be a follower of Allah. And you demonstrate that through these practices. And I think that's for a Muslim, that's the big thing. That's what I would say.
I've worked in a workforce in San Francisco, managed it, and where we had a large number of Muslims, and there were 4,500 employees in this one building, so it's a big building. And by working the courts, their religious freedom worked right into the workplace because we had marked on the wall of the building where the East is. And at times of prayer, the Muslims stop work and they pray right on the workroom floor. Their commitment is tremendous in terms of their faith, and in talking with those folks down there, they don't feel they need to overturn our political system at all because of the religious freedoms they have. Rather, they feel they can convert folks in America more effective than Mormons can to come around to their religion, and with time, we will become Muslim.
Islam has a great advantage among poor people. I mean, it from all kinds of standpoints. I mean, it's simple to understand. It shares the kind of millennial aspects in Christianity. It's a historical religion. There's a beginning and an end to history. You know, and there's a pilgrimage along the way, and it's one can identify where people are in that pilgrimage. And for that reason, I think it's again a very appealing. Plus, there is in Islam a very clear identification with the poor and obligations to the poor, to give them a portion of your own riches and wealth. And so I think it's a very appealing, and you know, that's probably part of the reason it catches on, especially in the African American community. It brings discipline, you know, kind of a very clear moral code again, easy to communicate.
In religions, we see what is written as the precepts and the requirements, and then there's how it is actually lived out. And we see some disparities in Christianity between what we're supposed to do and how we actually live that out. How much of that disparity is there in Islam?
Well, I wouldn't say that the disparity is in the believers. It's in, and what I really haven't focused on them. You know, my own study, I've focused on the states, and the Islamic ideal is rarely realized there. I mean, that it's been eroded in most places. You kind of have a continuum here from Saudi Arabia, I suppose, on the one hand, you know, where the constitution is the Quran. And, you know, everybody interpreting the law is, again, a legitimate Islamic lawyer. So you run from that to a country like Tunisia or Turkey, where, again, and somebody here has some relation to Turkey,
our
son-in-law. Mm-hmm. Even in a kind of secular Turkey, this idea of, you know, the wholeness of religion and state, church and, well, church is again a bad word to use in Islam, but religion politics is still, even in those secularized societies, are seen as one. I mean, nobody questions religious elements in the practice of the state. And the state really has never seriously challenged Islam. What they do is to try to keep the ulama under control, and to not let Islamic law creep back in and gobble up some of the areas where secular law or European law has already made inroads. But even that's changing in Turkey. I mean, you now have Islamic parties that are needed by the secular parties in order to govern. They can't govern by themselves anymore. And I'm sure that one of the conditions there is going to be, you know, as the religious parties in Israel, when they're needed in the coalition, there are going to be some minor concessions. I don't think, again, Turkey's going to back up beyond that. But yeah, it's, I mean, there have been a lot of erosions or concessions. The reality is, even in Saudi Arabia, is not the Islamic ideal, and there's all kinds of corruption in the Saudi ruling family. You know, that it sometimes comes out. And we have this case in 1964 where the ulama, who are really subservient in Saudi Arabia to the monarchy, called for the removal of King Saud. So, you know, I mean, it's even in a place that's geographically somewhat isolated and, you know, has tried, I think, to maintain something of the ideal, you have all kinds of erosion. So I think at that level, at the systemic level, there's a good deal of compromise with modernity. And, but that's what gives rise, you know, as it does in this country with, the Christian right, that very collision of modernity and religion provokes this reaction or backlash. And again, it's I think, more potent in the Islamic countries because there's this natural affinity that the poor have with Islam, and especially this the very clear message that the Islamists give out. I think that this, in fact, that I've read, I don't remember in which book it was anymore, that if Islamic fundamentalism didn't exist, there'd have to be another movement created to challenge the modern regimes in these third world countries that have Islamic influence.
So can you address the experiment that's going on in Jordan in that regard? Because it seems to me that Jordan is just such an example.
An example of a modernizing state in this case?
I mean, one in which the relationship between the religious community and the monarchy has a almost a cat and mouse game. I mean, they have an uneasy but agreed upon alliance.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think I hesitate agreeing with you entirely there because Jordan is such a complicated situation. Yeah. I mean, the overriding factor in Jordanian politics is the division between the Palestinians who live there, and I mean, the number over a million. And the non-Palestinian population. And I mean, the thing that unites them is, I think more than anything else, a quietism again on the part of the Muslims over against the king and the regime. The activity, the political energy that they have, I think is directed more than anything else at Israel and reclaiming the land of Palestine for the Palestinians. That helps the king, I think. I mean, it's not, from that standpoint, I don't think it's a great example. I mean, the king is a very savvy person in Jordan. And, you know, I mean, he's lived in Western countries. He understands political maneuvering. He has very loyal family members around him. And so, you know, I think he's got a lot more room for maneuver than many people do. But the major factor for the room for maneuver is the fact that so much of his population is looking really at Israel. What he gets into trouble, I think, is when, as happened in the Iranian Revolution, where, you know, Khomeini is making a certain claim for what Muslims should be doing politically, then, you know, this is, in a sense, a challenge. But Iranians have not been that much a factor now in Jordanian politics because of the antagonism between Iraq and Iran. So. Yes?
The role of the Inman in the Muslim faith. We've met with several of them in our travels in the Middle East, and they seem to be parallel to a parish pastor. I mean, they're the leader in a particular mosque, and they're the prayer leader. And their view, we've met with Shiite and Sunni, is one of peace. You know, they work with the peace communities. And
That's certainly the case in Israel, Palestine,
mm-hmm. and in Turkey.
Yeah. in Turkey and possibly in many places in Egypt. But because there is no church, there's no control over either the orthodoxy or the political activity or the political views of people who are leaders in mosques. Absolutely none. And in fact, some of the leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood have very advanced, there are ulama in that leadership, because again, there is no kind of code of doctrinal orthodoxy there. And so somebody who is a bit charismatic, has a gripe against the system, can use a position of again, being a learned person to challenge. Now, imam is more a feature, an elevated feature in the Shiite tradition, which itself, I didn't want to get into all of this because, you know, we're already out of time.
You
didn't push me in. It's my vice, not yours. But Shiism itself is divided into, different, I hesitate giving them any kind of structural definition, but they're movements. And one of them is called Twelvism, what the Iranians follow, that there were 12 men of kind of special and undisputed insight into the Sharia. These people lived again before, up until the middle of the 9th century. And the 12th one disappeared. And one of the things that gives leaders, especially in the 19th and 20th century, and of course the critical case here is Khomeini, some kind of fascination, legitimacy for the people, is that some people believe that this is the appearance of the disappeared 12th imam. There are the seven people in the Shiite tradition. But imam in Shiite tradition means people usually who have a special insight above the ordinary ulama. And you see these titles more in Shiism than you see in the Sunni tradition. If you look at the members of the government in Iran, some of them are ayatollahs. That's not the highest category, however. Marja is the highest category, and there were five of these at the time Ayatollah Khomeini came to power. You saw ayatollahs in the news a lot during the Iranian, not only Khomeini, but others. But an ayatollah does not necessarily have even the special insight, but certainly Khomeini did. And Khomeini, for 20 years before he led the Iranian Revolution, was kind of in the background manipulating who had this status of being a special enlightened person. When he came to power, one of the people who had this status was over in Iraq. This person happened to be, following a very kind of quiet policy with regard to interference in the political system, so he was easily dismissed. In fact, Khomeini charged him with collaborating with the Iraqi regime. Two of the other people had identified themselves too much with the Mujahideen, kind of militant fighters on the street, and so he dismissed those and he kind of manipulated himself, even though there were five people who had the status, he manipulated himself into the kind of chief enlightened one. And again, this became such a strong message, this is what you read on the street and banners and whatever, that again, for the ordinary, again, Shiite Muslim, he was, could be, the embodiment of the 12th imam.
Two more years.
Yeah, probably one more. We're out of time, and I'm sorry about that. I had to learn Terry's discipline here in stopping 15 minutes before the end. I get carried away. I'm sorry about that. So, there's a lot here. I always feel very guilty when I end a session here that there's so many things that I haven't covered or that I may have been too simplistic in dealing with. But I tried to do it objectively and accurately anyways. Okay, thank you. Have a good day.